Rhett Miller is the frontman for the rock band Old 97s, a solo singer, songwriter, an essayist, and a podcaster. He's also the father of two, which indirectly led to his newest gig, writing the new book No More Poems, a book in verse that just gets worse. He started writing these poems to share with his kids on the phone while he was on tour so he could talk to them, you know, longer. He'd read the poems aloud, he'd get their feedback. Sometimes it was brutal, but it kept him on the phone longer. Between albums with the band, Miller has squeezed in 7 solo records, most recently last year's The Messenger. His latest offering is a new podcast, Wheels Off. For that, he interviews musicians, writers, artists, actors, and comedians about creativity. Again, his new book is No More Poems, a book in verse that just gets worse, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Rhett Miller to the roundtable this morning. How are you, sir?
I'm fantastic. Thanks so much for having me at the roundtable.
It's really nice to have you on the program. I briefly told the story, but how did you start writing the poems and with your kids and having so much fun with it?
We love to read in my house. I grew up a kid of the library system. You know, I spent every waking hour, it seemed like, when I was growing up in the libraries, and I read every book on the shelf. I mean, that's an overstatement, but not by much. I really, really love books.
And a Texas kid, right?
Yeah, I was in Texas. And you know, a lot of summers would be brutally hot. When I was a kid, I was pretty awkward, or at least I felt pretty awkward. I didn't have a ton of friends, and so the books were really what got me through until I discovered music. So in my house with my two kids, the younger of whom just became a teenager, we read a lot. And we read a lot of Shel Silverstein and Edward Gorey and Roald Dahl, a lot of the kind of children's poetry that is sort of the opposite of the treacly stuff that I feel like talks down to kids. We read a lot of the stuff that assumes a level of intelligence on the part of the kid, the reader. And so when I started writing these poems to try and bond with my kids whilst on tour, which is the hardest part of my job, is having to be away from my kids.
Sure.
It was that. I really wanted not just to make them laugh, but I also wanted to kind of challenge them and sort of validate their own, you know, intelligence that I feel like gets overlooked so often.
Would you start the poem? Would you say, okay, this is where I'm headed with this, and then the kids would chime in?
I would come up with a complete first draft of something, usually sitting in like a coffee shop in Lexington, Kentucky or something, and they'd be at school. I remember the very first poem I wrote is one that didn't make it into the book. I had done a yoga class in whatever random city I was in, and I wrote a poem about the world's greatest yogi and how he was like in this perfect state of concentration, and this bead of sweat that's dripping down his nose threatens to ruin everything. And and I called my kids as soon as they got home from school. I'm like, I got a poem. It's kind of like a Shel Silverstein poem. And I read it to them, and they told me in no uncertain terms that kids don't want to hear poems about yoga.
Yoga didn't do it for the kids, huh?
No, and they have been so great because they are, like you said, they are brutally honest in their feedback. And it's good for me because, you know, a lot of times, you know, friends and relatives other than my kids will just say, oh, that's so cool. That's really neat that you wrote a poem. They are not giving me anything for free.
The grosser, the grimmer, the better, right?
That is true. I find that gallows humor plays well, not just with my own kids, but with kids in general.
So I was surprised, and I don't know how much you want to talk about this, but there was a little kerfuffle. So some parents have complained about one particular poem in the book of you, where I believe the part of the poem reads, "Feed your brother poison, maybe drop him down a well, and I'm the one who'll wind up living in a prison cell." I personally find that hilarious. However, this woman from Detroit apparently did not.
Yeah.
So what has changed? Because I grew up with Shel Silverstein, too. I also grew up, my mother, I think the first poem my mother ever read to me was a poem called Jelly Jake and Butter Bill, where they ate and ate and ate and gobbled at an awful rate till I'm sure they soon weighed more than double what they did before. And yet it's sad, and yet it's true. The floor gave way and they fell through. And then they never heard from them again. I wanted to hear that over and over and over again.
Yeah, I mean, when you're a kid, hyperbole plays well with kids.
Right.
You know, everything blown up to the nth degree. And when I wrote the poem that's created the controversy recently, I only intended it as humorous. Like, I never imagined that someone would read it and think it was a manual. Like one of the how-to guide. Well, that's what one of the headlines said, and somebody sent me an article that said, "Disgusting poet tells children how to kill their siblings," and I'm like, "Wow, that is not what I intended at all." In fact, it's funny, the stanza you just read was the stanza that I softened, because you know, Little Brown, my publisher, is they're as big as it gets,
yeah.
And they've got. Some of the smartest people in the world working there.
They're used to being sued.
Well, yeah, and they're used to seeing what's coming. You know, they read my book. They knew that this poem was inflammatory. That's why the word subversive appears in every press release about my book. You know, it's not easygoing fun. I mean, it is fun, but it's subversive. It's meant to be a little bit crazy.
But if this came out when we were kids, you're a couple of years younger than me. But if this came out when we were kids, it wouldn't be considered subversive.
No. I mean, think about Grimm's fairy tales.
Yeah.
There's a long tradition of children's literature in general, and especially like humorous children's poems, you know, dealing with kind of darker subjects. When you're a kid, fantasy runs wild, and
right.
A lot of that fantasy tends to be dark. I know for me, when they brought my little brother home from the hospital and I was a 2.5-year-old kid, my immediate thoughts went to very dark places. Sibling
yeah.
rivalry taken to the final step.
Take him back. Get rid of him.
Yeah.
Put him in a bag.
That's sort of what I wanted to spark discussion about. I just wanted kids to think about it and talk about it and realize why that kind of a response is, you know, ultimately unacceptable, but why it's also natural.
The other thing I find interesting about this whole controversy, I don't know, it just seems silly to me, but I mean, I understand people have, they certainly have, when parents want to oversee what their children read, well, that's fine. I have no problem with that. That's their duty as a parent. However, it does seem weird to make such a big deal out of something that is, as you say, clearly marked. But also, my goodness, as if you read these books of young adult and it's all about the end of the world and people killing each other and doing all these things. And I just wonder, well, at what point do we expect them to like snap from that this is going to be a manual to, oh, this could happen?
I don't know. I definitely, as you know, as a father of two kids who are now both teenagers, to see the sort of ubiquity of the dystopian future in everything that they read, it's hard. Like, I wonder, how did we get here? Like,
yeah.
I think they're. I hope that my kids don't feel that kind of hopelessness that I feel like pervades the, you know, what you know goes through their brains with their books, but. I don't know. I think kids can handle it. I think if it was something really grisly and something that felt real versus feeling like a joke, I think that, yeah, there'd be issues in this stuff. But even in the dystopian, you know, YA novels that you're referencing,
yeah.
I think even that, it's kids processing what seems frightening to them.
You have a great illustrator, and so you put the two together, these really fun poems and a great illustrator, and the book is just a blast.
Well, Dan Santat is a Caldecott Medal winner. He is, I found out, there were so many things, not being a children's author. When I got into this field, I didn't realize that I was doing everything wrong, you know? Like, poetry is a non-starter, typically, these days in children's literature.
Right.
There's a handful of people doing it, but typically
maybe,
publishers don't want it.
Maybe even in adult literature.
Yeah. Well, honestly, as sad as it was, I felt like the passing of Mary Oliver really did a lot
sure.
to force adults to read poetry and talk about poetry and appreciate poetry in a way that's been unsexy for a long time. But in the children's book world, like I didn't know a lot of things. And if I had known them that I was breaking all these rules, I might not have done it. So I think it's good. One thing I didn't know was that Dan Santat is the top illustrator in the country. And there's no way you're going to get Dan Santat. I heard him interviewed on a really great podcast called First Draft that Sarah Innie hosts out of California. And it's just they interview authors. And Dan's written children's books in addition to illustrating a ton of children's books. So I heard him and I thought he sounded really cool and sort of like-minded and like he would get these weird poems that I'd written. And so I went to Megan Tingley, who is my editor. I'm really lucky to have because she is sort of a really famous editor in the children's and youth world. And I went to Megan and said, what about Dan Santat? And she said, well, good luck. He's only the top illustrator in America. I don't think that's going to happen. And I said, well, we could ask. And she did. And he was totally into it. He got it. He said it reminded him of the kind of the kookier, darker, more subversive stuff that he liked that he didn't see coming out a lot in this field anymore. And he wanted to be a part of it. I got super lucky.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful book. Do you mind reading one of these?
I was hoping you'd ask. Yeah.
Yes.
My homework. I did my homework, but I lost it. My mom might have thought it was garbage and tossed it. My stupid sister might have hid it. One thing's for certain, though, I did it. I remember it took me over an hour, which left me without even time to shower. If I smell ripe, then that's the reason. And also, right now, it's basketball season. My dad might have grabbed it to write down a number. As he gets older, he is getting dumber. How does he manage to hold down a job? He's ditzy as heck, and he's kind of a slob. I guess it's not all my family's fault. I could keep my homework locked in a vault with skulls and crossbones and 17 locks under a mountain of stinky old socks, or handcuff a briefcase onto my wrist to carry the homework, I swear, does exist. Police motorcade? A squadron of goons? I should have hired soldiers, entire platoons, to bring you my homework. What's that you say? We didn't have any work due for today? Nothing? For real? No homework assigned? Never mind.
Red Miller reading from his new book, No More Poems, a book in verse that just gets worse. I understand you're also writing a novel.
Well, talking about writing is like the opposite of writing, but it's my dream to finish a piece of long-form fiction, yeah.
So you write this, you write poetry, you write a novel, and so the next thing would be a memoir, but is that really come out in the songs? Is that through the songwriting helps you with what you're dealing with day-to-day?
For sure. For years, I sort of ascribed subscribed to the theory that there's no place for autobiography in song. Like I thought that it was important that the song be universal by not being tied to my own experience in any obvious way. And it was only three or four years ago when I realized that universality can be reached through like personal, you know, recollection and personal details. And so I gave myself permission for the last couple of old 97s albums and solo record to kind of go there in a way I hadn't before. So in music, I've been able to scratch the itch that I think memoir is ultimately the thing that, you know, people go to scratch that itch. I don't know that I'm going to do a memoir anytime soon.
Yeah. You in the songs you address your sobriety. You've been sober for
four years.
And was there a moment where you thought, okay, I can talk about this now?
Yeah, it's a scary thing. Before I became sober, whenever I would meet someone who was sober, I felt so sorry for them. Like, oh God, you must have really screwed up to have your party end like that. And it's only once you kind of come out the other side that you realize what a gift it is to be able to kind of go through every day without having to feel like you have to self-medicate. And certainly for me, that was the experience. But yeah, the first year or two is tricky. It's really hard to navigate. And I haven't fully leaned on the 12-step world. I certainly see its value. During those first couple of years, I really needed other people and people who were going through it or had gone through it. For instance, Jason Isbell is famously sober, and he's a really great singer-songwriter. And I remember emailing back and forth with him, like, what do you think? Should I talk about this? I'm afraid if I talk about this, it'll wind up being the only thing I talk about in these interviews. And so many of my songs are about booze and about you know, poor decisions.
Right.
And I still sing them every night, and I still have fans walk up and set, you know, glasses of brown amber liquid at my feet while I'm performing. You know, so it would be disingenuous for me to say that that's not something that I'd still actively have to deal with. But I feel like now it's easier to talk about because it's less touch and go for me.
So is there a disconnect? So when you sing a song like Let's Get Drunk and Get It On, that it there's a disconnect, that it's maybe the whatever 25-year-old you singing it.
Yeah, although I wrote that song when I was probably 42, so.
Well, there's that.
Yeah.
But still.
No, it's funny. When I think musicians, as far as I can tell, friends of mine that do what I do, there's a trick when you're singing a song, you sort of time travel into the moment where you were when you wrote the song. So when I'm singing it, I kind of get to go back to that moment, and I get to, you know, feel the sort of dire feelings that I was going through when I wrote that song. Or so the disconnect happens, but it's sort of I get to skip it. I get to sort of be in that other place, and then the song ends and I'm back where I am now, and I'm happy where I am now.
Right, because it's a story. You're telling a story.
Yeah.
And the origin of the story doesn't necessarily have to be connected every time you sing it.
And even the most autobiographical song for me is still, okay, there's a character, there's a narrator, there's always a disconnect. There's
right.
a guy in the song, and then there's me. I couldn't do all that stuff.
You even address a suicide attempt at a very young age. You were 14.
Yeah.
You have 14-year-old children.
Yeah, 13 and 15 now.
So
yeah, they're
right between.
There.
What is that like?
And that's sort of why I finally decided to address that in song. You know, I'd only a few years before that started to even acknowledge it in interviews. It's something that when it's a part of your narrative, it feels so, it's such a tricky thing because you're ashamed of, I was ashamed of having gotten to such a dark place and having tried to kill myself. And then I was ashamed anytime it would come up of feeling like I was dining out on it. You know, it's like, ugh, I can't win for losing with this thing. But the more work I started to do with suicide prevention groups like the Suicide Prevention Network, and then groups like the group out of Texas called OK to Say and mental health awareness groups, I realized that if we avoid these things, we further the stigma. And so I felt like for me, talking about it was a useful thing, not just for the kids that might hear it, but for me as well, because it sort of destigmatizes it in my own personal history. But I feel like if I can address it with my art, I mean, that's how I've always processed stuff.
Right.
And that's how I feel most comfortable communicating. It's something that really feels good and natural and useful to me.
14 is such a young age, and you think to be at that depth.
But I think most 14-year-olds are.
Yeah.
Again, we talked a minute ago about how kids can handle stuff.
Sure.
I mean, that said, kids end up being asked to handle a lot of things, especially when hormones become an issue.
Right.
And when you're really on the brink of adulthood, and when the stakes get so much higher, but your brain isn't equipped yet to process the fact that the stakes are so much higher. And I mean, I think it's not uncommon for adolescents to get to that point where, especially if they're genetically predisposed towards depression. And so I know for me, that's the thing. I thought I had it all figured out. I thought I saw the end game, and I just wanted to skip to that. You know, I've
cut
seen
to the
everything,
chase.
Everything there is to see. And really, I know for me that when I came to, I was taken to a hospital from a parking lot of a 7-Eleven where I'd finally passed out after I'd taken a bunch of pills and drank a bunch of poison, basically. And they took me to a hospital and they induced vomiting for the whole night.
Yeah.
And I came to the next morning, and I was singing a song as I reemerged, as I sort of woke up, and to me that immediately and always thereafter felt important. Like the music was the thing that was there for me when I came out, and it was my way out. And for me, it kind of became the meaning of my life and helped me figure a path through all of that darkness.
So when I started to battle depression, I was, well, I learned about it or realized what it was, what was happening to me when you wake up in the fetal position, mm-hmm. and when I was an adult. And then, but then you look back on it and think, oh, well, this is something I've had for a really, really long time, and I didn't even realize it. And then when you start to come out of it, you realize, oh, I wasted a lot of time here where I could have gotten help. And then you try to think to yourself, well, I don't know where I would have gotten it.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know who I would have gone to. I mean, I could have gone to my parents. My parents were very wonderful, sweet people. But I don't know. I don't think I ever would have done that.
When I studied transcendental meditation years ago, and yeah. there's a thing when you're doing TM, and I think probably any meditation, non-branded, is that when you go down into a meditative state and you really achieve a state of, because the whole point is to achieve a state of no thought. Anyway, when you're in that state of no thought, you're not aware of it. And you're not aware of it until you emerge from it on the other side. And then you look back on it and you realize, wow, I just spent however long in the unified field in this state of no thought. I think there's a thing that happens too with, and I think this maybe goes for sobriety as well, because when you kind of come out of feeling like you have to drink a pint of whiskey and a half bottle of red wine and smoke weed, you know, when you come out of that world, you look back on it and think like, oh my gosh, there was all this stuff going on that I wasn't aware of at the time. And I think it's the same with depression. Like you can look back on it and see it, but when you're in it, sort of by definition, you can't see where you're at.
You feel like you've just lived through a movie that you didn't realize was in color.
Yeah. And I think now I want to go back and rewatch so many movies because I was like, I don't remember anything about these movies, much less my own life.
Yeah. So tell me about Old 97. So, you know, the first time I saw you was on The Letterman Show, and I think it was 1999. You were singing 19, and you looked about 16. But you were probably in your mid-20s, mid to late-20s. Tell me a little bit about the origin of the band and how it has grown, allowing you to both solo and go back and forth with the group.
The thing that happened with the Old 97s that I always thought of as some kind of a curse but has really proven to be a blessing was that when we very first got going, we had come out of these bands where we were trying really hard to get signed, get famous, make money, do all the things that really are the killer of art.
Right.
So when we kind of realized like, oh, we're just, this isn't working. I say we because Murray, the bass player in the Old 97s, and I had been in bands for years before the Old 97s. We stopped for months and then we looked at each other and said, let's do a band that stands no chance of succeeding. We'll just be a folky, country, acoustic band. And as I've done the Wheels Off podcast that you mentioned, these interviews where I just talk to creative people, I've discovered that the less important you make money or, acclaim in the equation, the more likely you are to come up with something that's successful, by which I don't mean necessarily making money, but something that achieves what you're hoping to achieve, like communicating to other people, connecting with other people, good art. Maybe that's self-evident, but sort of the more pure it is, the greater chance something is going to really be great or good or connecting. So with the 97s, of course, that's the thing that finally worked and people really liked it. And suddenly we were packing clubs and we were selling records. And the name Old 97s is something that I would never have agreed to if I had thought we were going to really do something commercially viable, because apparently the word old is anathema to marketing. But we, at the time, in 1992, 93, we didn't think we were going to be a band even in 1997, much less 22 years after that. So really, we've gotten kind of lucky. The fact that we never have had a hit, I think, is a good thing for us, because so many of my friends that were in bands in the 90s wound up now having to go out on the package tours in the summer where it's them and two other bands that had a hit in the 90s, and nobody cares about the records they've made in the 20 whatever years since then. They only want to hear the song that was a hit in 1995. And if that was my life, I don't think I'd still be doing it. But the fact that I've been able to maintain a sort of critically acclaimed mid-level career has wound up really being a really cool, lucky thing. And I'm able to support my two kids. I've got 3 acres in the Hudson Valley where we kind of randomly wound up, but I love it. And I can't believe how beautiful it is here. And I feel like I won the lottery.
Do you think about that idea of not going after something and then falling into the success? How much of that plays into, because you mentioned this earlier, of marketing, of the machine that is around you of labels and so forth that is trying to pump out whatever they can because they may have a different view. They obviously want to sell as much as they can.
Yeah. Elektra Records would have loved if we had gone the path of Third Eye Blind, our label mates at the time. But, you know, now when I see Third Eye Blind referenced, it's usually as a punchline to a joke. I was always the one in the band that would fight, not on behalf of the label, but I was always the one that really wanted us to have the best chance to go out and, you know, push through to the next level, always the next level. I felt like and maybe this was a failing of my youth, but I was always impatient. It's something I've finally kind of, I think, gotten better about, but it's been a battle for me my whole life, this impatience. Like, what am I in a hurry to get to? You know, we're all headed the same place. So, I do think marketing is a necessary evil, and I'm glad people do it. But I think if you get too hung up on it, then if you let it dictate your product or whatever, your art, then you're going to fail.
Do you think about that pace of what you're doing? Of you've got the podcast, you've got the book, you've got the solo career, you've got the band. And as you say, you're just, it's always, you're in a hurry, you're in a hurry, you're in a hurry. And then, so you'll be 50 soon, right?
A couple of years, yeah.
I just got there. Oh, boy.
Congratulations.
Very fun.
Yeah.
I don't know. So what do you think? Is it like you feel like you're running out of time, or you just want to get as much in, or, and this is what I've latched onto, you know what? I'm just having fun.
I think it's more the second and third rather than running out of time. That hasn't occurred to me yet, and except in that sort of distant thought of, I wonder at what point I'm going to feel like I'm up against it, you know, where the clock is really ticking.
Yeah.
That hasn't occurred to me yet. I really love making things, whether it's music or poems or, you know, essays or someday hopefully long form fiction. It's, or even these interviews I'm doing. I feel like, you know, people in my life have said, well, are you making money off the podcast? I'm like, do people make money off podcasts?
No, they don't.
But like, for me, the reward is in the doing of it, like in all of it, in the creating of songs and writing and stuff. But the interviews have really surprised me, because the getting to interview these people, and it's gone beyond just musicians and comedians and actors. You know, I got to interview Michael Chabon, the writer, recently, and he's a friend of mine, but I'd never spent 45 minutes picking his brain like that, in a way that I'd be ashamed to do if we were just at his dinner table.
Sure.
But there we were, all with microphones. Even Brian Anderson, the sportscaster, who wouldn't seem like he'd be an obvious choice for an interview about creativity, the way he approaches his job was so fascinating, and the way he was able to communicate what goes into doing what he does at the level he does it. It's so brilliant, that these people, and the way it's so different, the way everyone approaches it, I feel like I get so much out of it just talking to these people. Forget about if they're ever going to monetize it.
And the point where it's still gratifying, and then you think of new things that you want to do, the wheels are always turning.
Yeah, and that's like, I never expected I would do children's poems, and it really did start just as a trick to get my kids to spend more time on FaceTime with me, even if they were roasting me mercilessly. And the fact that it turned into something that, you know, a company as cool and amazing as Little Brown is, would put it out there in the world, and I would get an illustrator like Dan, and people would take it seriously. Like, these things, I never even really thought music would be what it is and give me the life that it's given me. I think it's important to be grateful, and you're lucky if you can be consistently surprised by what life has to offer.
The podcast is called Wheels Off. The new solo album that came out last year is The Messenger, and the new book is No More Poems by Rhett Miller. It's published by Little Brown with art by Dan Santat. It is a book in verse that just gets worse, and it's a lot of fun. Rhett Miller, a great pleasure to have you on the program. What a delight to have you here.
It's great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the new book is No More Poems, a book in verse that just gets worse. It is published by Little Brown. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.